Well, our featured guest today is a former Australian journalist who went to Iraq to act as a human shield during the 2003 war. Donna Mulhern was there for the siege of Fallujah in April 2004, where she witnessed hundreds of Iraqis being killed and was kidnapped by local fighters. When she returned to Australia, she found herself treated like a traitor. And to help channel her anger over what she'd seen, Donna Mulhern returned several times to Iraq as an humanitarian aid worker to set up a shelter for street kids in Baghdad and to assist homeless families. The 7th anniversary of the start of the war has passed in just this past week, and still 100,000 troops remain stationed in Iraq, with the US planning to halve that number by August. And 7 years after she made the extraordinary decision to place herself in the middle of a war zone, Donna Mulhern has written of what made her go and what she saw. Donna Mulhern joins us now on the line from Brisbane. Thanks for being with us.
No, it's a pleasure, Catherine. Thank you.
So you go from being a journalist, and indeed you were a media advisor to a state government, typically thick-skinned, even a bit cynical individuals, to making this extraordinary decision to go and place yourself in a war zone. What was it that brought you to that point?
Well, there was a period between after I'd left my job in politics to when I heard the call to become a human shield, and that was, I guess, the important period and formative time. And that was when I decided to leave politics for a specific reason, because I was becoming too cynical and too hard-nosed and too aggressive, and I didn't want to be like that, but I wanted to make a difference in the world somehow. I left my job and embarked on a pilgrimage. It was a personal journey, like an inner journey. For example, I went to Tibet and lived in a Buddhist nunnery. I went to the wilderness of Alaska. And I was also exploring my own spirituality. I was practicing meditation in the Christian tradition. I developed a contemplative dimension. But most importantly, I was exploring the teaching, the very radical teaching that we have in the Christian tradition of nonviolence. And maybe so radical that the church has not been able to practice it for the last couple of thousand years, in fact. You know, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. So this... Yeah, it's very challenging, and I wanted to explore what does this mean, how can we put it into practice. So it was in the middle of asking these questions on this journey that the war in Iraq started to brew, and I heard the call to the human shields. So it was almost a natural response for me to respond.
You had been through a very great personal transformation. This had come after a personal trauma in your life where you'd perhaps looked at traditional Christianity and the traditional practices of Christianity and rethought a lot about what that meant.
That's right, exactly. I was what I would call myself a raving evangelical fundamentalist. I was very judgmental. Everything to me was black and white. There was the truth and I had it and others didn't, and I felt sorry for them and I tried to convert them. It was quite very arrogant, but it was very judgmental, and in that way it was scary. And when I found myself in a position where I was judged and they turned on me, that was it was devastating for me. It was just my marriage breakdown, but I was isolated, I was questioned, I was challenged about that. And then I was forced to ask myself the question, Donna, would you have done the same? Would you have acted this way too? Are you like this? And I decided that I was like that, and I wanted to change. And so I threw everything up in the air, my beliefs and everything and my judgment, and sought something new and something different and something more compassionate. And what I was led to and what I found was this inner spirituality, this contemplative, more mystical tradition of Christianity. And that was transformative. Nothing was really the same after that discovery.
When you say heard the call, that again would be a very familiar phrase for people who often go into religious life. For you, was it a definite sense that someone or something was calling you to Iraq? What do you mean by that?
It was a definite physical call by a man on the radio. So I was preparing my backpack to go on the next leg of my pilgrimage. In January 2003, I was heading off to Egypt to live in some desert monasteries in Egypt to do some meditation and silence. And I heard on the radio an interview with a guy named Ken O'Keefe, a former US Marine. He'd fought in the first Gulf War in 1991, became so traumatized by that experience himself, became an anti-war advocate. And he had the idea. His thinking was, look, it seems okay for our governments to invade these countries in the Middle East because... and hurt people because they seem somehow different to us, that they are Arabs and Muslims, and their names are Rehab and Yusuf and Ahmed. He said, but what if we went there too? Us from the West, white people, and our names were John and Donna and Karen and Peter. What would happen then? It was this concept of white privilege, that some lives are considered more valuable than others. He said, surely if we came in mass numbers, that would make it impossible for the US and the Coalition of the Willing to implement their war policies. So I was listening to this on the radio and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I thought it was an amazing idea and it fitted perfectly with my beliefs on non-violence and my opposition to war. So I knew as soon as I heard the call that I had to go.
Were you scared? Did you stop and say, I'm putting my life at risk, I'm going from Aussie to a war zone?
Well, at that period, when I was preparing to go, and it was only 2 weeks then since I heard the call to when I ended up in Baghdad, so I actually spent more time calming down the fears of others. Although I was thoughtful, I was reflective, and I thought through all of the consequences. That's why some people called me naive, some people called me crazy, some people called me brave. I deny all three of them. I thought through the consequences. I thought I could be injured or killed. I may not come home, but I decided to go anyway, and I knew that this is what I wanted to do. There's a note in the book where I write, when I boarded the plane to go to Iraq, I didn't know what would happen next. I didn't know when I would come home. But my goal was not to stay alive. My goal was to stay human. And I felt fully alive. I actually felt like I was being who I was meant to be. I was fulfilling a purpose. I was expressing my humanity. So that was my most dominant feeling. Feeling scared? Well, sure, that came later. That came when I was in Baghdad. That came when the missiles were falling. 7 years ago now, we were going through the shock and awe campaign, and that was absolutely terrifying. But through that, I had this sense of being on a mission.
You get there, and what is it you are confronted with?
Well, when I first arrived, I was confronted with an amazingly vibrant and colourful city full of life, which was not what I expected. I had very low expectations of Baghdad, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't know much about this country. I thought the only thing I knew about it was Saddam Hussein and the wars and the sanctions, so I thought it must be quite a miserable, dark and gloomy place. And I was very wrong and very embarrassed about that. It's a place very sophisticated, very cosmopolitan, very open, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, a lot of harmony in the country, highly educated people, highly cultured, you know, poetry readings by the river, the National Theatre in the centre of town, music coming out of the coffee shops. Their main problem was Saddam Hussein. And freedom of expression, that they couldn't speak freely or have political opinions. But in spite of him, they still maintained their humanity and their sense of celebration of life. And I was very impressed by that. So it was a joy and a privilege to be with the Iraqi people. They were warm and hospitable, and they were funny. They had a great sense of humour. They were cheeky, and many of them spoke English very well. So we were able to live together and communicate and rise above the politics and just be human beings together. So that was a privilege.
It's ironic, after you leaving a formal religious structure and going on this spiritual journey of your own, that you then find, if there's politics anywhere, it's actually perhaps among the other human shields. When two or three are gathered, we shall argue.
Absolutely. Here we were, a peace movement, peace activists come together to stop a war, and we were at each other's throats for a lot of the time. Well, politics develops in any organisation, I guess, and a bureaucracy developed and red tape and egos and power plays. And thus that happened in the Human Shield. Some scenes were Monty Python-esque, actually. We were arguing, for example, our biggest argument was over a logo that we would put on our letterhead. Some argued it should be this logo, some argued it should be others. And then the other main argument was about who was the leader of the movement. Was it Ken O'Keefe who made the call, or would we have no leader? Why do we need a leader? And so these arguments developed, and there was factions and there was politics. I was asked to join this side or that side, and it was very frustrating for me, to be honest, and very sad to witness this. But, you know, we got through all of those periods and stuck with the mission and tried to stay focused.
Before the bombing begins, you were with these Iraqi people. You are already seeing and meeting people who have a huge impact on you, including some of the children that you met in orphanages.
That's right. The children had a great impact on me, and one of the children I met in an orphanage was little baby Nora, and she was significant because as I was walking through this orphanage run by Mother Teresa's order, it was for children with disabilities, and they were severely disabled, and there was one little baby who was in a cot, and she was looking up at me and smiling. The thing about her, baby Nora, was that she had no arms and no legs. She was a little torso and a head. And the reason she had no arms and legs was born with this deformity, was because she was from the south of Iraq, where depleted uranium, which was used widely in the first Gulf War, had affected her, as it had thousands and thousands of children. But the amazing thing about her was she was smiling and giggling and blowing raspberries, and I picked her up and held her, and she nuzzled into my neck and was giggling, and it was just such a beautiful thing to hold this baby. And I went back regularly to spend time with baby Nora, and because she gave me such a great source of energy and joy. And the other children would follow us around town and practice their schoolroom English, and they were very cheeky and mischievous kids, and they were just a joy to be around.
You've made it clear that you're no apologist for the regime of Saddam Hussein. What was it you believe should have happened in Iraq other than invasion?
Well, I think we should have explored non-violent alternatives to responding to the situation in Iraq. What we need to look at here was what actually were the motives for war? What was the real agenda? And from the Pentagon's point of view, their agenda, let's take the Iraqi point of view, what they feel the agenda was, and that is control of the area, the region, a geopolitical goal to maintain a base in that region, and also control of resources. So if that's your motive and your agenda, well, you will implement that by war and occupation. They were, however, using other excuses and reasons, weapons of mass destruction. Well, we could have continued the inspections as the French and German leaders were urging us to do, because they were working. Was it about Saddam Hussein? Well, okay, I'm going to be a little bit cynical here, because the Iraqi people used to say to us, well, for a start, you're about 20 years too late. And secondly, who emboldened Saddam during the 80s? Who provided military aid, political aid and financial aid to him in the war against Iran? That was the US and the West. And if you wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein, well, surely there's another way. Can't you get one man? Can't we do this non-violently? So, yeah, unfortunately, there were other motives involved that ensured that the Pentagon moved in and the US administration with their war machine and their tanks and guns.
I'm speaking with Donna Mulhern, who went to Iraq in 2003, just ahead of the invasion, and became one of a number of overseas people to go there to act as human shields. Where did you place yourselves? What sorts of sites?
We chose 5 sites that were critical infrastructure scattered around Baghdad. And so these were important humanitarian sites, including water treatment plants, power stations, communication centres, etc. So we chose 5 sites. We had criteria we wanted for those sites, that they were safe for us to be at for that period. And we went and lived on those sites for the period of the bombing of Baghdad so that we could protect those sites. We wrote a letter to the Pentagon and to all of our government leaders saying we're the human shields, we are from these countries, and we are living on these sites. We gave the exact coordinates. That was very important. And we told them, if you bomb these sites, you will kill us because we are here.
And your reaction when you are in the thick of it and the reality of it is what?
Well, war is something that none of us on the site I was at had ever experienced before. So most days felt surreal. There was the whole shutdown of Baghdad, this very vibrant city of 5 million people became a ghost town. The bombing began at first at night, and then it became 24 hours going around the clock. It's hard to describe the impact of a bomb. I try to do it in the book so that people can imagine. It's an assault on all of the senses. The noise is so loud you feel your eardrums might explode or bleed from the inside. The room is shaking. The building is shaking. It's like a personal earthquake just for your building. The windows might implode and smash and fly across the room, the glass and shrapnel. You hear people screaming, you hear the sirens, there's a smell of things burning, there's the call to prayer from the mosque would also always cry out. It gave a very eerie feeling when the missiles were falling. And all the while I was crouched up against a wall with my hands over my head, just thinking, you know, is the next one going to hit us? Is the next one going to hit us? And every breath I took, I was very grateful for that breath, and you were living very much by the moment. And when the sun rose, you were grateful that you lived to see another day. So obviously it was terrifying and traumatic for us. But all I could think about at that time, I was a 30-something relatively strong adult, all I could think about was the kids. Like, children were enduring this. Like a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, what would they be thinking? How would they be coping? And later on I learnt exactly how they were coping when I went to the hospitals. And many were hospitalised because of the symptoms of severe shock, vomiting, nausea, uncontrollable shaking, hyperventilation. They had to be sedated. And there were many women who were pregnant women who had lost their unborn babies, who had miscarried because of shock. So this physical and mental and emotional impact on the children was very, very serious and continues to this day. Let's remember that if you're 7 years old today in Iraq, this is all you know. You've grown up with the war going on around you, and soon those kids who are seven will be 12 and 14 and grow up to be adults. And I guess we've contributed to their worldview and how they look at the world. So I think looking back 7 years on, we've got a lot of responsibility still to be caring for these children and teenagers, and thinking about how can we respond to make Iraq a better place.
This goes on day and night for days and weeks, and during the day you're out visiting the residential areas and the hospitals and seeing the results of the bombing. You go back to Australia, I think, because of rising distress within your family. This was in 2003. Was that why you ended that first period of acting as a human shield and went home?
Well, there were a few reasons. It all came to a head seemingly on the one day. Human shields were leaving on various days for different reasons. I had a principle, and other human shields shared it with me, that I did not want to meet American soldiers on the streets of Baghdad. It was partly principle and it was partly pride. And also, we didn't know what they would do when they saw us. Would they consider us enemy? Would they take us and hold us captive? Would they claim that they rescued us? Would they shuffle us off to Guantanamo Bay? We had no idea. And some of us did not want to find out, and we also didn't know how we would respond personally, if we would be angry or aggressive towards them. So a few of us tried to figure out the days that the aerial bombing was finishing up and the days that the ground war had begun and the troops were coming into Baghdad. So we tried to time it to leave in that window, which we were able to do. So I avoided meeting those troops. Although I did meet Australian troops on the way out, that's a different story.
It is a story of what? Polite to you, but...
Polite to me, but forcing Iraqi families and elders onto the ground, onto their knees, in the dust, putting their face in the dust and putting a machine gun against their back, demanding answers to questions, you know, in English no less. And I was infuriated by the way that the soldiers were treating the Iraqi people, because these people were elders and it was their country. And these Australian soldiers were the invaders. So I wanted to scream at them, because I saw this out of the minibus when I was driving. And I was very ashamed at what I saw. And that's what I was concerned about, that I would see that right throughout Baghdad. So the other thing that happened on the day we decided to leave was that communications were cut and we were no longer able to telephone out interviews and reports or send by internet any of our interviews or reports. And the last thing that happened, which was the clincher, was I got through to my mother on the phone and I heard her voice and she was hysterical with fear and I made her sick. And so my gut reaction was that I needed to honour her, because she'd given me her blessing to go, and she said, come home now, come home now. And so that was the clincher. When all those things happened on the one day, I decided it was time for me. So this was about 12, 13 days into the bombing that a few of us left into Jordan.
You go home, and what is it that you experience when you get back to Australia?
Well, I experienced quite a hostile reaction from some sectors of the Australian community and from the media. So the media wasn't so much interested in hearing about an eyewitness to war, except to, I guess, string me up as some kind of a Saddam cheerleader or accuse me of being traitorous. And that was very disappointing. And there was talkback radio sessions I did, and one man rang up with his voice shaking with anger, saying, you know, if I meet that girl, I'll spit in her face because, you know, she's a traitor. And it was very disturbing. And people were ringing up, criticising me and what I did in very harsh, judgmental ways. And it was bewildering for me, because I remember screaming back at the radio one night, who are you people? You know, you've never met me. You don't know really what I did over there. And felt very free, though, to just make up whatever they wanted and just criticise. And I just kept asking myself, what was it about what I'd done that was so threatening for them? What was it that was making them angry? What were they fearing about what I did?
Can you answer? This was very early. This was before we knew what we know now about weapons of mass destruction and whether or not they ever existed, and about the reasons that were given for going to war in Iraq. How do you answer the question of why they were so reactive to what you did?
Well, part of it, I guess, was ignorance in that they didn't actually know what I did, because some of them were making statements like, you were endangering other people. Well, how I was doing that, I don't know, because we weren't, but they were imagining something else. So obviously they didn't know that I was sitting at a water treatment plant. You were endangering the troops. Again, I don't know how they imagined that. So part of it was just ignorance, and they were filling in what they didn't know with their own imagination. But the other part, I think, was maybe the fact that we did have troops over there from Australia, and they felt that somehow I was in opposition to those troops. Well, in reality, I was in opposition to our government's policy. It was what I was in opposition to. And I would have loved the troops to get home ASAP. So I was very, when I saw the troops in Iraq initially, the Australian ones, they'd looked like sitting ducks to me. They were in the middle of this desert dressed up like Rambo in a war that we had no reason to be in. So my heart went out to them thinking, gee, I wish you could just go home. And so I had this more of a compassionate response to them at that stage. So I think once the troops were there, Australians felt, well, we all had to support the war, and if you don't, well, then you are traitorous.
It's just gone 10:30 on Radio New Zealand National. I'm speaking with Donna Mulhern, over the author of the book Ordinary Courage, telling the story of her time in Iraq, which expands much longer than going there as a human shield in the first days of the war. You went back to Iraq a number of times to set up a school to help traumatised children, to provide therapy, and to set up a shelter for street kids. And you were there in Fallujah during the raid on Fallujah. What was it that you witnessed there?
Well, we call it the Massacre of Fallujah. And I was one of only half a dozen foreigners who witnessed that, because the whole city was cut off. Nobody was allowed in, nobody was allowed out in terms of media or foreigners or anything. So, and then the US military assaulted the city in many ways, from the air with missiles, with bombs. But the most devious thing and the most damaging tactic was snipering. They placed soldiers on the tops of rooftops of houses and the minarets of mosques, and their orders was to shoot anything that moved on the street, any human being. Now, we were in Baghdad when it first started, and we got calls from doctors at a hospital who knew some of our crew, and they said, look, if you call yourself human shields, you need to get to Fallujah, because they're shooting our children and our civilians. And we said, our first reaction was, well, hang on, don't exaggerate, you know, we really need to know what's going on. And they said, we're not exaggerating, you need to come, because they were doctors in ambulances trying to deliver aid, and they were being shot at. So we smuggled ourselves into Fallujah with some local people on the back of a pickup truck on country roads, and we came, and that's exactly what we witnessed. We saw the bodies on the street. We dragged them off, bodies of civilians. Fallujah City Hospital had been closed down, only to be used for US servicemen and women only. So people in Fallujah who were wounded could only go to doctor's surgeries and many makeshift clinics that were set up by doctors, you know, in back rooms of houses, in garages, etc. Now, I was at one of these clinics, and it was really wasn't equipped to do the job. They kept the blood in a Coke machine. There was no anaesthetic, and I was seeing the bodies coming in. And most of them never had a chance, with gunshot wounds through the head. And I saw on one day at least the bodies of 6 children and 3 or 4 women. And there were so many deaths in Fallujah in those days that they had to dig up Fallujah soccer field, Fallujah Oval, because the graveyard was overflowing. They couldn't fit any more bodies in the cemetery. It was the definition of a massacre, and it was absolutely horrifying. And one of the images I carry from that is a little girl I met on the footpath who was carrying a Kalashnikov in her hand. She was about 8 years old, and she held it up to her and looked at me with such anger in her eyes. And I took a photo of her because of the shocking, it was a shocking image to me, a little girl like this holding this machine gun. And some of the women called me over and said, oh, you think that's interesting, do you? You want to take a photo of this little girl? And I said, well, yeah, I think it's really disturbing. And they said, well, you know what we think is disturbing? They said, we think it's disturbing that you come from a culture where you think it's okay to kill children. And I said, well, hang on a minute, you know, I don't believe that, and I don't believe our culture thinks it's okay to kill children. I went, oh, okay. They said, well, let us rephrase. You come from a culture where you think it's okay to kill our children. And I couldn't argue, because the bodies were at my feet, and that's exactly what had happened. And then they said, let's tell you the story of that little girl who just a few days before, for some reason, her father had gone out onto the street. They don't know why. He was a pharmacist. Perhaps he was wanting to deliver medicines or something. He was shot and slumped onto the street. I don't know if he was dead or injured, but his wife responded immediately and I guess a bit recklessly by running immediately out onto the street to try to get him. She was shot and killed. So this little girl had just lost her mother and her father. The neighbours went into the little girl. She was about 8 years old and she had two little brothers and sisters, 3 years old and two. This little girl was now the head of her household, the protector of her brothers and sisters. So the neighbours gave her a Kalashnikov and taught her how to use it. So she was holding a gun to protect herself from us. She was radicalised and was taught, well, you will need to protect yourself with violence because these people from America and Australia and England might want to hurt you. I was just absolutely devastated to hear that because I knew that would create a cycle in that girl's life and those other children's lives. And what we need to try to do in the world today is break the cycle. Otherwise, it'll just go on and on and on. And that's what non-violence can do. It can actually break the cycle.
You were kidnapped yourself while in Fallujah, but by whom and in what circumstances?
Yeah, we were driving out of Fallujah after the time we'd spent there and got caught in crossfire between Iraqi Mujahideen fighters and US military. And we thought we were going to die in the car by bullets. And the guy driving the car, an American, had his head down and used his hand on the accelerator to move the car just out of the crossfire. We didn't know in which direction we were heading, but we ended up driving into an Iraqi Mujahideen headquarters. And here we were, you know, four guys representing exactly the coalition of the willing. We were British, Australian and American. And so the fighters were like, well, hello, who are you? You know, that we could well have been spies, CIA, whatever, undercover agents. And so we were held by those fighters. And we were questioned and interrogated as to who we were, why we were there, what we were doing. And I got the most attention because I was Australian. They asked where we were from. Okay, England, Australia, England, America. Okay, you guys go. It's almost like they expect bad behaviour from those countries. Australia? They say, you're from Australia? We'll sit down. And when they were questioning me, it was more with sadness than with anger. So they looked me straight in the eye and they said, why do Australians want to hurt us? Why are Australians here? Of all people, why are Australians here? We love Australians. They're great at sport. They're great people. They're friendly. Why are they here? It was heartbreaking for me to have to try to answer for that. And so then I had to talk about our political system, about who John Howard was, about how there's different parties and how about not everyone agrees. And when I was telling them that I felt that most Australians didn't support the war, they then said, well, hang on a minute, but how could you go to war if your people don't support it? Well, they said, don't they vote? And I said, well, there wasn't actually a vote. There wasn't debated in the parliament. The Prime Minister made this cabinet decision. And then, of course, they raised their eyebrows and said, all right, the people didn't support it. You didn't have this parliamentary vote. And you want to bring us democracy? You know, they felt very cynical about that.
How would you communicate with them? Did you have translators with you?
We had translators with us the whole time. And so there was a rapid translation going on. And the other aspect is that many Iraqis learn English at school. They're highly educated people. And some of them could speak excellent English. And many could speak broken English.
You went back again to Iraq in November 2004. Tell me about the work that you did with Street Kids and where those projects are at now.
Yeah, we were providing food, accommodation and safety, basically, for children who had found themselves living rough on the street, somehow dislocated from their families or had lost their families. And they were having to, you know, steal food to survive and everything. So we got them off the street. Our goal was to help them calm down and ease their aggression and their trauma. So we did a lot of therapy with them, like play therapy, art therapy, music, drama, sport. And we were very successful, I think, in being able to help those little boys just be able to act as little boys again. And we found long-term accommodation for them and tried to reunite them with their extended families. We also assisted refugee families from Fallujah who had become internally displaced. So you had this city of 250,000 people who had to flee their city and set up camps on football fields and parks and university grounds in Baghdad. So in my second and third trips, we were providing emergency assistance to those people from Fallujah.
I know you suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder when you had been through all this. There's so much more we could talk about, but What I'd like to ask you finally is where things are at now. As we said, 7th anniversary of the war up, still 100,000 troops there. A plan for that to be halved by August. Do you see that as feasible? And what do you believe will happen if and when there is full withdrawal?
Well, I think a full withdrawal should be expedited. I think it would be a helpful thing, a helpful start for the healing of the country that the troops are withdrawn. Because I see Iraq as a country on fire. It's still very chaotic. There's still a lot of violence going on. And the fuel that's feeding that fire is the presence of foreign occupying troops, the foreign armies, the foreign bases, the foreign contractors, the foreign control. Now, when that is withdrawn, I think there will be, you know, some upheaval, some of the chaos will continue, but eventually it will be sorted out and will settle down. There'll be political power plays, etc. But that fuel that's just feeding that fire of violence every day, once that's gone, there's a chance for the Iraqi people to start again. So let's look at Iraq at the moment. The goals of the coalition, the willing, have failed on every level. Terrorism has not decreased in the world. It has increased. Iraq is not stable, more stable than it was. It is less stable. Iraq is not a better democracy. It is a dodgy democracy because of the influence we're seeing. I mean, they've just had an election that's highly questionable in terms of some candidates were not even allowed to run in the election, etc. So still there's a lot of work to be done in that country. But if I was the US administration, I'd be feeling pretty poorly about the results. And of course they are acknowledging that it has not been a successful military campaign. But in the meantime, the Iraqi people are living in a city they can barely recognise from 7 years ago. So the city has moved from this very vibrant, open and quite harmonious city that I witnessed to a city divided up into sections with blast walls and huge 6 feet concrete walls and a divide between people groups that had never existed before to this degree. It was a theological difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims, not a personal one. So there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of healing, but I think the Iraqi people are ready to take it on and they are looking forward to doing that on their own when those troops have gone.
Thank you, Donna. Donna Mulhern's book is called Ordinary Courage. It's published by PN9, and if you want to purchase it, $37.99 the price.